to pray. Chapter 124. When the elevator door opened, the lights in the temple room were all ablaze. Catherine Solomon's legs still felt rubbery as she hurried in to find her brother. The air in this enormous chamber was cold and smelled of incense. The scene that greeted her stopped her in her tracks. In the center of this magnificent room, on a low stone altar, lay a bloody, tattooed corpse, a body perforated by spears of broken glass. High above, a gaping hole in the ceiling opened to the heavens.
My God!
Catherine immediately looked away, her eyes scanning for Peter. She found her brother sitting on the other side of the room, being tended to by a medic, while talking with Langdon and Director Sato.
Peter!
Catherine called, running over.
Peter!
Her brother glanced up, his expression filling with relief. He was on his feet at once, moving toward her. He was wearing a simple white shirt and dark slacks, which someone had probably gotten for him from his office downstairs. His right arm was in a sling, and their gentle embrace was awkward, but Catherine barely noticed. A familiar comfort surrounded her like a cocoon, as it always had, even in childhood, when her protective older brother embraced her. They held each other in silence. Finally, Catherine whispered,
"Are you okay? I mean, really?"
She released him, looking down at the sling and bandage where his right hand used to be. Tears welled again in her eyes.
"I'm so, so sorry."
Peter shrugged as if it were nothing of consequence. "Mortal flesh. Bodies don't last forever. The important thing is that you're okay." Peter's light-hearted response tore at her emotions, reminding her of all the reasons she loved him. She stroked his head, feeling the unbreakable bonds of family, the shared blood that flowed in their veins. Tragically, she knew there was a third Solomon in the room tonight. The corpse on the altar drew her gaze, and Catherine shuddered deeply, trying to block out the photos she had seen. She looked away, her eyes now finding Robert Langdon's. There was compassion there, deep and perceptive, as if Langdon somehow knew exactly what she was thinking.
"Peter knows."
Raw emotion gripped Catherine. Relief, sympathy, despair. She felt her brother's body begin trembling like a child's. It was something she had never witnessed in her entire life.
"Just let it go,"
she whispered.
"It's okay. Just let it go."
Peter's trembling grew deeper. She held him again, stroking the back of his head.
"Peter, you've always been the strong one. You've always been there for me. But I'm here for you now. It's okay. I'm right here."
Catherine eased his head gently onto her shoulder, and the great Peter Solomon collapsed, sobbing in her arms. Director Sato stepped away to take an incoming call. It was Nola Kay. Her news, for a change, was good.
"Still no signs of distribution, ma'am." She sounded hopeful. "I'm confident we would have seen something by now. It looks like you contained it."
"Thanks to you, Nola,"
Sato thought, glancing down at the laptop which Langdon had seen complete its transmission.
"A very close call."
At Nola's suggestion, the agent searching the mansion had checked the garbage cans, discovering packaging for a newly purchased cellular modem. With the exact model number, Nola had been able to cross-reference compatible carriers, bandwidths, and service grids, isolating the laptop's most likely access node, a small transmitter on the corner of 16th and Corcoran, 3 blocks from the temple. Nola quickly relayed the information to Sato in the helicopter. On approach toward the house of the temple, the pilot had performed a low-altitude flyover and pulsed the relay node with a blast of electromagnetic radiation, knocking it offline only seconds before the laptop completed its transfer.
"Great work tonight," Sato said. "Now get some sleep. You've earned it."
"Thank you, ma'am."
Nola hesitated.
"Was there something else?"
Nola was silent a long moment, apparently considering whether or not to speak.
"Nothing that can't wait till morning, ma'am. Have a good night."
Chapter 125.
in the silence of an elegant bathroom on the ground floor of the House of the Temple. Robert Langdon ran warm water into a tile sink and eyed himself in the mirror. Even in the muted light, he looked like he felt. Utterly spent. His day bag was on his shoulder again, much lighter now, empty except for his personal items and some crumpled lecture notes. He had to chuckle. His visit to D.C. tonight to give a lecture had turned out a bit more grueling than he'd anticipated. Even so, Langdon had a lot to be grateful for.
Peter is alive, and the video was contained.
As Langdon scooped handfuls of warm water onto his face, he gradually felt himself coming back to life. Everything was still a blur, but the adrenaline in his body was finally dissipating, and he was feeling like himself again. After drying his hands, he checked his Mickey Mouse watch.
My God, it's late.
Langdon exited the bathroom and wound his way along the curved wall of the Hall of Honor, a gracefully arched passageway lined with portraits of accomplished masons, U.S. presidents, philanthropists, luminaries, and other influential Americans. He paused at an oil painting of Harry S. Truman and tried to imagine the man undergoing the rites, rituals, and studies required to become a Mason. There is a hidden world behind the one we all see. For all of us.
You slipped away,
a voice said down the hall. Langdon turned. It was Catherine. She'd been through hell tonight, and yet she looked suddenly radiant, rejuvenated somehow. Langdon gave a tired smile. How's he doing? Catherine walked up and embraced him warmly.
How can I ever thank you?
He laughed. You know I didn't do anything, right? Catherine held him for a long time.
Peter's going to be fine.
She let go and looked deep into Langdon's eyes.
And he just told me something incredible. Something wonderful.
Her voice trembled with anticipation.
I need to go see it for myself. I'll be back in a bit.
What? Where are you going?
I won't be long. Right now, Peter wants to speak with you, alone. He's waiting in the library.
Did he say why? Catherine chuckled and shook her head.
You know Peter and his secrets.
But...
I'll see you in a bit.
Then she was gone. Langdon sighed heavily. He felt like he'd had enough secrets for one night. There were unanswered questions, of course. The Masonic Pyramid and the Lost Word among them. But he sensed that the answers, if they even existed, were not for him. Not as a non-Mason. Mustering the last of his energy, Langdon made his way to the Masonic Library. When he arrived, Peter was sitting all alone at a table with the stone pyramid before him.
Robert?
Peter smiled and waved him in.
I'd like a word.
Langdon managed a grin. Yes, I hear you lost one. Chapter 126. The library in the House of the Temple was D.C.'s oldest public reading room. Its elegant stacks burgeoned with over 250,000 volumes, including a rare copy of the Ahiman Rezon, The Secrets of a Prepared Brother. In addition, the library displayed precious Masonic jewels, ritual artifacts, and even a rare volume that had been hand-printed by Benjamin Franklin. Langdon's favorite library treasure, however, was one few ever noticed. The illusion. Solomon had shown him long ago that from the proper vantage point, the library's reading desk and golden table lamp created an unmistakable optical illusion. That of a pyramid and shining golden capstone. Solomon said he always considered the illusion a silent reminder that the mysteries of Freemasonry were perfectly visible to anyone and everyone if they were seen from the proper perspective. Tonight, however, the mysteries of Freemasonry had materialized front and center. Langdon now sat opposite the worshipful master Peter Solomon and the Masonic Pyramid. Peter was smiling.
The word you refer to, Robert, is not a legend. It is a reality.
Langdon stared across the table and finally spoke. But I don't understand. How is that possible?
What is so difficult to accept?
All of it, Langdon wanted to say, searching his old friend's eyes for any hint of common sense. You're saying you believe the Lost Word is real, and that it has actual power?
Enormous power, Peter said,
It has the power to transform humankind by unlocking the ancient mysteries.
A word? Langdon challenged. Peter, I can't possibly believe a word.
You will believe, Peter stated calmly.
Langdon stared in silence.
As you know, Solomon continued, standing now and pacing around the table, it has long been prophesied that there will come a day when the lost word will be rediscovered, a day when it will be unearthed, and mankind will once again have access to its forgotten power.
Langdon flashed on Peter's lecture about the apocalypse. Although many people erroneously interpreted apocalypse as a cataclysmic end of the world, the word literally signified an unveiling, predicted by the ancients to be that of great wisdom, the coming age of enlightenment. Even so, Langdon could not imagine such a vast change being ushered in by a word. Peter motioned to the stone pyramid which sat on the table beside its golden capstone.
The Masonic pyramid, he said, the legendary symbol on. Tonight it stands unified and complete.
Reverently he lifted the golden capstone and set it atop the pyramid. The heavy gold piece clicked softly into place.
Tonight, my friend, you have done what has never been done before. You have assembled the Masonic pyramid, deciphered all of its codes, and in the end unveiled this.
Solomon produced a sheet of paper and laid it on the table. Langdon recognized the grid of symbols that had been reorganized using the Order 8 Franklin Square. He had studied it briefly in the temple room.
Peter said, I am curious to know if you can read this array of symbols. After all, you are the specialist.
Langdon eyed the grid. Herodom, circumpunct, pyramid, staircase. Langdon sighed. Well, Peter, as you can probably see, this is an allegorical pictogram. Clearly its language is metaphorical and symbolic rather than literal.
Solomon chuckled. Ask a symbologist a simple question.
Okay. Tell me what you see.
Peter really wants to hear this?
Langdon pulled the page toward him.
Well, I looked at it earlier, and in simple terms, I see that this grid is a picture, depicting heaven and earth.
Peter arched his eyebrows, looking surprised.
Oh?
Sure. At the top of the image, we have the word Herodom, the holy house, which I interpret as the house of God, or heaven.
Okay.
The downward-facing arrow after Herodom signifies that the rest of the pictogram clearly lies in the realm beneath heaven, that being earth.
Langdon's eyes glided now to the bottom of the grid.
The lowest two rows, those beneath the pyramid, represent the earth itself, terra firma, the lowest of all the realms. Fittingly, these lower realms contain the 12 ancient astrological signs, which represent the primordial religion of those first human souls who looked to the heavens and saw the hand of God in the movement of the stars and planets.
Solomon slid his chair closer and studied the grid.
Okay. What else?
On a foundation of astrology, Langdon continued, the Great Pyramid rises from the earth, stretching toward heaven, the enduring symbol of lost wisdom. It is filled with history's great philosophies and religions, Egyptian, Pythagorean, Buddhist, Hindu, Islamic, Judeo-Christian, and on, all flowing upward, merging together, funneling themselves up through the transformative gateway of the pyramid, where they finally fuse into a single, unified human philosophy. He paused. A single universal consciousness, a shared global vision of God, represented by the ancient symbol that hovers over the capstone.
The circumpunct, Peter said, a universal symbol for God.
Right. Throughout history, the circumpunct has been all things to all people. It is the sun god Ra, alchemical gold, the all-seeing eye, the singularity point before the Big Bang,
the great architect of the universe.
Langdon nodded, sensing this was probably the same argument Peter had used in the temple room to sell the idea of the circumpunct as the lost word.
And finally, Peter asked, what about the staircase?
Langdon glanced down at the image of the stairs beneath the pyramid. Peter, I'm sure you know as well as anyone, this symbolizes the winding staircase of Freemasonry, leading upward out of the earthly darkness into the light, like Jacob's ladder climbing to heaven,
or the tiered human spine that connects man's mortal body to his eternal mind. He paused. As for the rest of the symbols, they appear to be a blend of celestial, Masonic, and scientific, all lending support to the ancient mysteries. Solomon stroked his chin.
An elegant interpretation, Professor. I agree, of course, that this grid can be read as allegory.
And yet,
his eyes flashed with deepening mystery, this collection of symbols tells another story as well, a story that is far more revealing.
Oh?
Solomon began pacing again, circling the table. Earlier tonight, inside the temple room, when I believed I was going to die, I looked at this grid, and somehow I saw past the metaphor, past the allegory, into the very heart of what these symbols are telling us. He paused, turning abruptly to Langdon. This grid reveals the exact location where the lost word is buried.
Come again?
Langdon shifted uneasily in his chair, suddenly fearing that the trauma of the evening had left Peter disorientated and confused.
Robert, legend has always described the Masonic Pyramid as a map, a very specific map, a map that could guide the worthy to the secret location of the lost word.
Solomon tapped the grid of symbols in front of Langdon.
I guarantee you, these symbols are exactly what legend says they are. A map. A specific diagram that reveals exactly where we will find the staircase that leads down to the lost word.
Langdon gave an uneasy laugh, treading carefully now.
Even if I believed the legend of the Masonic Pyramid, this grid of symbols can't possibly be a map. Look at it. It looks nothing like a map.
Solomon smiled. Sometimes all it takes is a tiny shift of perspective to see something familiar in a totally new light.
Langdon looked again but saw nothing new.
Let me ask you a question, Peter said. When masons lay cornerstones, do you know why we lay them in the northeast corner of a building?
Sure, because the northeast corner receives the first rays of morning light. It is symbolic of the power of architecture to climb out of the earth into the light.
Right, Peter said. So perhaps you should look there for the first rays of light.
He motioned to the grid.
In the northeast corner.
Langdon returned his eyes to the page, moving his gaze to the upper right or northeast corner. The symbol in that corner was the downward arrow.
A downward pointing arrow, Langdon said, trying to grasp Solomon's point.
Which means beneath Herodom.
No, Robert, not beneath, Solomon replied. Think, this grid is not a metaphorical maze. It's a map. And on a map, a directional arrow that points down means
south,
Langdon exclaimed, startled.
Exactly, Solomon replied, grinning now with excitement. Due south. On a map, down is south.
Moreover, on a map, the word Herodom would not be a metaphor for heaven. It would be the name of a geographic location.
The house of the temple?
You're saying this map is pointing due south of this building?
Praise God, Solomon said, laughing. Light dawns at last.
Langdon studied the grid.
But Peter, even if you're right, due south of this building could be anywhere on a longitude that's over 24,000 miles long.
No, Robert. You are ignoring the legend, which claims the lost word is buried in D.C.
That shortens the line substantially.
In addition, legend also claims that a large stone sits atop the opening of the staircase, and that this stone is engraved with a message in an ancient language, as a kind of marker, so the worthy can find it.
Langdon was having trouble taking any of this seriously, and while he didn't know D.C. well enough to picture what was due south of their current location, he was pretty certain there was no huge engraved stone atop a buried staircase.
The message inscribed on the stone, Peter said,
is right here before our eyes.
He tapped the third row of the grid before Langdon.
This is the inscription, Robert. You've solved the puzzle.
Dumbfounded, Langdon studied the seven symbols.
Solved?
Langdon had no idea whatsoever what these seven disparate symbols could possibly mean. And he was damn sure they were not engraved anywhere in the nation's capital, particularly on a giant stone over a staircase.
Peter, he said, I don't see how this sheds any light at all.
I know of no stone in D.C. engraved with this message.
Solomon patted him on the shoulder. You have walked past it and never seen it.
We all have. It is sitting in plain view, like the mysteries themselves. And tonight, when I saw these seven symbols, I realized in an instant that the legend was true. The lost word is buried in D.C., and it does rest at the bottom of a long staircase beneath an enormous engraved stone.
Mystified, Langdon remained silent.
Robert, tonight I believe you have earned the right to know the truth.
Langdon stared at Peter, trying to process what he had just heard.
You're going to tell me where the lost word is buried?
No, Solomon said, standing up with a smile.
I'm going to show you.
5 minutes later, Langdon was buckling himself into the back seat of the Escalade beside Peter Solomon. Simpkins climbed in behind the wheel as Sato approached across the parking lot.
Mr. Solomon,
the director said, lighting a cigarette as she arrived.
I've just made the call you requested.
And? Peter asked, through his open window.
I ordered them to give you access. Briefly.
Thank you.
Sato studied him, looking curious.
I must say it's a most unusual request.
Solomon gave an enigmatic shrug.
Sato let it go, circling around to Langdon's window and rapping with her knuckles.
Langdon lowered the window.
Professor,
she said, with no hint of warmth.
Your assistance tonight, while reluctant, was critical to our success, and for that I thank you.
She took a long drag on her cigarette and blew it sideways.
However, one final bit of advice. The next time a senior administrator of the CIA tells you she has a national security crisis,
her eyes flashed black.
Leave the bullshit in Cambridge.
Langdon opened his mouth to speak, but Director Inoue Sato had already turned and was headed off across the parking lot toward a waiting helicopter.
Simpkins glanced over his shoulder, stone-faced. Are you gentlemen ready?
Actually, Solomon said, just one moment. He produced a small folded piece of dark fabric and handed it to Langdon. Robert, I'd like you to put this on before we go anywhere.
Puzzled, Langdon examined the cloth. It was black velvet. As he unfolded it, he realized he was holding a Masonic hoodwink, the traditional blindfold of a first-degree initiate.
What the hell?
Peter said, I'd prefer you not see where we're going.
Langdon turned to Peter.
You want to blindfold me for the journey?
Solomon grinned.
My secret? My rules.
Chapter 127. The breeze felt cold outside CIA headquarters in Langley. Nola Kaye was shivering as she followed SysSec Rick Parrish across the agency's moonlit central courtyard.
Where is Rick taking me?
The crisis of the Masonic video had been averted, thank God, but Nola still felt uneasy. The redacted file on the CIA director's partition remained a mystery, and it was nagging at her. She and Sato would debrief in the morning, and Nola wanted all the facts. Finally, she had called Rick Parrish and demanded his help. Now, as she followed Rick to some unknown location outside, Nola could not push the bizarre phrases from her memory. Secret location underground, where the... Somewhere in Washington, D.C., the coordinates... Uncovered an ancient portal that led... Warning, the pyramid holds dangerous... Decipher this engraved symbol on to unveil...
You and I agree, Parrish said as they walked, that the hacker who spidered those keywords was definitely searching for information about the Masonic pyramid.
Obviously, Nola thought. It turns out, though, the hacker stumbled onto a facet of the Masonic mystery I don't think he expected.
What do you mean?
Nola, you know how the CIA director sponsors an internal discussion forum for agency employees to share their ideas about all kinds of things?
Of course.
The forums provided agency personnel a safe place to chat online about various topics and gave the director a kind of virtual gateway to his staff. The director's forums are hosted on his private partition, and yet in order to provide access to employees of all clearance levels, they're located outside the director's classified firewall.
What are you getting at?
She demanded as they rounded a corner near the agency cafeteria.
In a word,
Parrish pointed into the darkness,
That. Nola glanced up. Across the plaza in front of them was a massive metal sculpture, glimmering in the moonlight. In an agency that boasted over 500 pieces of original art, this sculpture, titled Kryptos, was by far the most famous. Greek for hidden, Kryptos was the work of American artist James Sanborn, and had become something of a legend here at the CIA. The work consisted of a massive S-shaped panel of copper, set on its edge like a curling metal wall. Engraved into the expansive surface of the wall were nearly 2,000 letters, organized into a baffling code. As if this were not enigmatic enough, positioned carefully in the area around the encrypted S-wall were numerous other sculptural elements, granite slabs at odd angles, a compass rose, a magnetic lodestone, and even a message in Morse code that referenced lucid memory and shadow forces. Most fans believed that these pieces were clues that would reveal how to decipher the sculpture. Kryptos was art, but it was also an enigma. Attempting to decipher its encoded secret had become an obsession for cryptologists both inside and outside the CIA. Finally, a few years back, a portion of the code had been broken, and it became national news. Although much of Kryptos's code remained unsolved to this day, the sections that had been deciphered were so bizarre that they made the sculpture only more mysterious. It referenced secret underground locations, portals that led into ancient tombs, longitudes and latitudes. Nola could still recall bits and pieces of the deciphered sections. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location. It was totally invisible. How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field. Nola had never paid much attention to the sculpture or cared if it was ever fully deciphered. At the moment, however, she wanted answers. "Why are you showing me Kryptos?" Parrish gave her a conspiratorial smile and dramatically extracted a folded sheet of paper from his pocket. "Voila, the mysterious redacted document you were so concerned about. I accessed the complete text." Nola jumped. "You snooped the director's classified partition?" "No. That's what I was getting at earlier. Have a look." He handed her the file. Nola seized the page and unfolded it. When she saw the standard agency headers at the top of the page, she cocked her head in surprise. This document was not classified. Not even close. Employee Discussion Board. Kryptos. Compressed Storage. Thread number 2456282.5. Nola found herself looking at a series of postings that had been compressed into a single page for more efficient storage. "Your keyword document," Rick said, "is some cypherpunks rambling about Kryptos." Nola scanned down the document until she spotted a sentence containing a familiar set of keywords. "Jim, the sculpture says it was transmitted to a secret location underground where the info was hidden." "This text is from the director's online Kryptos forum," Rick explained. "The forum's been going for years. There are literally thousands of postings. I'm not surprised one of them happened to contain all the keywords." Nola kept scanning down until she spotted another posting containing keywords. "Even though Mark said the code's lat long headings point somewhere in Washington, D.C., the coordinates he used were off by 1 degree. Kryptos basically points back to itself." Parrish walked over to the statue and ran his palm across the cryptic sea of letters. "A lot of this code has yet to be deciphered, and there are plenty of people who think the message might actually relate to ancient Masonic secrets." Nola now recalled murmurs of a Masonic Kryptos link, but she tended to ignore the lunatic fringe. Then again, looking around at the various pieces of the sculpture arranged around the plaza, she realized it was a code in pieces, a symbolon, just like the Masonic pyramid. Odd. For a moment, Nola could almost see Kryptos as a modern Masonic pyramid, a code in many pieces, made of different materials, each playing a role. "Do you think there's any way Kryptos and the Masonic Pyramid might be hiding the same secret?" "Who knows?" Parrish shot Kryptos a frustrated look. "I doubt we'll ever know the whole message. That is, unless someone can convince the director to unlock his safe and sneak a peek at the solution." Nola nodded. It was all coming back to her now. When Kryptos was installed, it arrived with a sealed envelope containing a complete decryption of the sculpture's codes. The sealed solution was entrusted to then-CIA Director William Webster, who locked it in his office safe. The document was allegedly still there, having been transferred from director to director over the years. Strangely, Nola's thoughts of William Webster sparked her memory, bringing back yet another portion of Kryptos's deciphered text. It's buried out there somewhere. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. Although nobody knew exactly what was buried out there, most people believed that WW was a reference to William Webster. Nola had heard whispers once that it referred, in fact, to a man named William Whiston, a Royal Society theologian, although she had never bothered to give it much thought. Rick was talking again. "I've got to admit, I'm not really into artists, but I think this guy Sanborn's a serious genius. I was just looking online at his Cyrillic projector project. It shines giant Russian letters from a KGB document on mind control. Freaky." Nola was no longer listening. She was examining the paper where she had found the third key phrase in another posting. "Right, that whole section is verbatim from some famous archaeologist's diary, telling about the moment he dug down and uncovered an ancient portal that led to the tomb of Tutankhamun." The archaeologist, who was quoted on Kryptos, Nola knew, was in fact famed Egyptologist Howard Carter. The next posting referenced him by name. "I just skimmed the rest of Carter's field notes online, and it sounds like he found a clay tablet warning the pyramid holds dangerous consequences for anyone who disturbs the peace of the pharaoh. A curse. Should we be worried? Smiley face." Nola scowled. "Rick, for God's sake, this idiot's pyramid reference isn't even right. Tutankhamun wasn't buried in a pyramid. He was buried in the Valley of the Kings. Don't cryptologists watch the Discovery Channel?" Parrish shrugged. "Techies." Nola now saw the final key phrase. "Guys, you know I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but Jim and Dave had better decipher this engraved symbol on to unveil its final secret before the world ends in 2012. Ciao." "Anyhow," Parrish said, "I figured you'd want to know about the Kryptos Forum before you accused the CIA director of harboring classified documentation about an ancient Masonic legend. Somehow I doubt a man as powerful as the CIA director has time for that sort of thing." Nola pictured the Masonic video and its images of all the influential men participating in an ancient rite. If Rick had any idea. In the end, she knew, whatever Kryptos ultimately revealed, the message definitely had mystical undertones. She gazed up at the gleaming piece of art, a three-dimensional code standing silently at the heart of one of the nation's premier intelligence agencies, and she wondered if it would ever give up its final secret. As she and Rick headed back inside, Nola had to smile. It's buried out there, somewhere. Chapter 128. This is crazy. Blindfolded, Robert Langdon could see nothing as the Escalade sped southward along the deserted streets. On the seat beside him, Peter Solomon remained silent. Where is he taking me? Langdon's curiosity was a mix of intrigue and apprehension, his imagination in overdrive as it tried desperately to put the pieces together. Peter had not wavered from his claim. The lost word? Buried at the bottom of a staircase that's covered by a massive engraved stone? It all seemed impossible. The stone's alleged engraving was still lodged in Langdon's memory, and yet the seven symbols, as far as he could tell, made no sense together at all. The stonemason's square, the symbol of honesty and being true. The letters AU, the scientific abbreviation for the element gold. The sigma, the Greek letter S, the mathematical symbol for the sum of all parts. The pyramid, the Egyptian symbol of man reaching heavenward. The delta, the Greek letter D, the mathematical symbol for change. Mercury, as depicted by its most ancient alchemical symbol. The Ouroboros, the symbol of wholeness and at-one-ment. Solomon still insisted these seven symbols were a message. But if this was true, then it was a message Langdon had no idea how to read. The Escalade slowed suddenly and turned sharply right onto a different surface, as if into a driveway or access road.
Langdon perked up, listening intently for clues as to their whereabouts. They'd been driving for less than 10 minutes, and although Langdon had tried to follow in his mind, he had lost his bearings quickly. For all he knew, they were now pulling back into the House of the Temple. The Escalade came to a stop, and Langdon heard the window roll down.
"Agent Simpkins, CIA," their driver announced. "I believe you're expecting us?"
"Yes, sir,"
a sharp military voice replied.
"Director Sato phoned ahead. One moment while I move the security barricade."
Langdon listened with rising confusion, now sensing they were entering a military base. As the car began moving again along an unusually smooth stretch of pavement, he turned his head blindly towards Solomon.
"Where are we, Peter?" he demanded.
"Do not remove your blindfold." Peter's voice was stern. The vehicle continued a short distance and again slowed to a stop. Simpkins killed the engine. More voices. Military. Someone asked for Simpkins' identification. The agent got out and spoke to the men in hushed tones. Langdon's door was suddenly being opened, and powerful hands assisted him out of the car. The air felt cold. It was windy. Solomon was beside him.
"Robert, just let Agent Simpkins lead you inside."
Langdon heard metal keys in a lock, then the creak of a heavy iron door swinging open. It sounded like an ancient bulkhead. "Where the hell are they taking me?" Simpkins' hands guided Langdon in the direction of the metal door. They stepped over a threshold.
"Straight ahead, Professor."
It was suddenly quiet. Dead. Deserted. The air inside smelled sterile and processed. Simpkins and Solomon flanked Langdon now, guiding him blindly down a reverberating corridor. The floor felt like stone beneath his loafers. Behind them, the metal door slammed loudly and Langdon jumped. The locks turned. He was sweating now beneath his blindfold. He wanted only to tear it off. They stopped walking now. Simpkins let go of Langdon's arm, and there was a series of electronic beeps followed by an unexpected rumble in front of them, which Langdon imagined had to be a security door sliding open automatically.
"Mr. Solomon," Simpkins said, "you and Mr. Langdon continue on alone. I'll wait for you here. Take my flashlight."
"Thank you," Solomon said.
"We won't be long."
Flashlight. Langdon's heart was pounding wildly now. Peter took Langdon's arm in his own and inched forward.
"Walk with me, Robert."
They moved slowly together across another threshold, and the security door rumbled shut behind them. Peter stopped short.
"Is something wrong?"
Langdon was suddenly feeling queasy and off balance.
"I think I just need to take off this blindfold."
"Not yet. We're almost there."
"Almost where?"
Langdon felt a growing heaviness in the pit of his stomach.
"I told you. I'm taking you to see the staircase that descends to the last word."
"Peter, this isn't funny."
"It's not meant to be. It's meant to open your mind, Robert. It's meant to remind you that there are mysteries in this world that even you have yet to lay eyes upon. And before I take one more step with you, I want you to do something for me. I want you to believe, just for an instant, believe in the legend. Believe that you are about to peer down a winding staircase that plunges hundreds of feet to one of humankind's greatest lost treasures."
Langdon felt dizzy. As much as he wanted to believe his dear friend, he could not.
"Is it much farther?"
His velvet hoodwink was drenched in sweat.
"No. Only a few more steps, actually. Through one last door. I'll open it now."
Solomon let go of him for a moment, and as he did so, Langdon swayed, feeling light-headed. Unsteady, he reached out for stability, and Peter was quickly back at his side. The sound of a heavy automatic door rumbled in front of them. Peter took Langdon's arm, and they moved forward again.
"This way."
They inched across another threshold, and the door slid closed behind them. Silence. Cold. Langdon immediately sensed that this place, whatever it was, had nothing to do with the world on the other side of the security doors. The air was dank and chilly like a tomb. The acoustics felt dull and cramped. He felt an irrational bout of claustrophobia settling in.
"A few more steps."
Solomon guided him blindly around a corner and positioned him precisely. Finally he said, "Take off your blindfold." Langdon seized the velvet hoodwink and tore it from his face. He looked all around to find out where he was, but he was still blind. He rubbed his eyes. Nothing.
"Peter, it's pitch black."
"Yes, I know. Reach in front of you. There's a railing. Grasp it." Langdon groped in the darkness and found an iron railing. "Now watch." He could hear Peter fumbling with something, and suddenly a blazing flashlight beam pierced the darkness. It was pointed at the floor, and before Langdon could take in his surroundings, Solomon directed the flashlight out over the railing and pointed the beam straight down. Langdon was suddenly staring into a bottomless shaft, an endless winding staircase that plunged deep into the earth.
"My God!"
His knees nearly buckled, and he gripped the railing for support. The staircase was a traditional square spiral, and he could see at least 30 landings descending into the earth before the flashlight faded to nothing.
"I can't even see the bottom."
"Peter,"
he stammered,
"what is this place?"
"I'll take you to the bottom of the staircase in a moment. But before I do, you need to see something else." Too overwhelmed to protest, Langdon let Peter guide him away from the stairwell and across the strange little chamber. Peter kept the flashlight trained on the worn stone floor beneath their feet, and Langdon could get no real sense of the space around them, except that it was small.
A tiny stone chamber.
They arrived quickly at the room's opposite wall, in which was embedded a rectangle of glass. Langdon thought it might be a window into a room beyond, and yet from where he stood, he saw only darkness on the other side.
"Go ahead," Peter said. "Have a look."
"What's in there?" Langdon flashed for an instant on the chamber of reflection beneath the Capitol building, and how he had believed, for a moment, that it might contain a portal to some giant underground cavern.
"Just look, Robert."
Solomon inched him forward. "And brace yourself, because the sight will shock you." Having no idea what to expect, Langdon moved toward the glass. As he neared the portal, Peter turned out the flashlight, plunging the tiny chamber into total darkness. As his eyes adjusted, Langdon groped in front of him, his hands finding the wall, finding the glass, his face moving closer to the transparent portal. Still only darkness beyond. He leaned closer, pressing his face to the glass. Then he saw it. The wave of shock and disorientation that tore through Langdon's body reached down inside and spun his internal compass upside down. He nearly fell backward as his mind strained to accept the utterly unanticipated sight that was before him. In his wildest dreams, Robert Langdon would never have guessed what lay on the other side of this glass. The vision was a glorious sight. There in the darkness, a brilliant white light shone like a gleaming jewel. Langdon now understood it all. The barricade on the access road, the guards at the main entrance, the heavy metal door outside, the automatic doors that rumbled open and closed, the heaviness in his stomach, the lightness in his head. And now this tiny stone chamber.
"Robert," Peter whispered behind him, "sometimes a change of perspective is all it takes to see the light."
Speechless, Langdon stared out through the window. His gaze traveled into the darkness of the night, traversing more than a mile of empty space, dropping lower, lower, through the darkness, until it came to rest atop the brilliantly illuminated, stark white dome of the U.S. Capitol building. Langdon had never seen the Capitol from this perspective, hovering 555 feet in the air atop America's great Egyptian obelisk. Tonight, for the first time in his life, he had ridden the elevator up to the tiny viewing chamber at the pinnacle of the Washington Monument. Chapter 129 Robert Langdon stood mesmerized at the glass portal, absorbing the power of the landscape below him. Having ascended unknowingly hundreds of feet into the air,
He was now admiring one of the most spectacular vistas he had ever seen. The shining dome of the U.S. Capitol rose like a mountain at the east end of the National Mall. On either side of the building, two parallel lines of light stretched toward him. The illuminated facades of the Smithsonian Museums, beacons of art, history, science, culture. Langdon now realized, to his astonishment, that much of what Peter had declared to be true was in fact true. There is indeed a winding staircase, descending hundreds of feet beneath a massive stone. The huge capstone of this obelisk sat directly over his head, and Langdon now recalled a forgotten bit of trivia that seemed to have eerie relevance. The capstone of the Washington Monument weighed precisely 3,300 pounds. Again, the number 33. More startling, however, was the knowledge that this capstone's ultimate peak, the zenith of this obelisk, was crowned by a tiny polished tip of aluminum, a metal as precious as gold in its day. The shining apex of the Washington Monument was only about a foot tall, the same size as the Masonic Pyramid. Incredibly, this small metal pyramid bore a famous engraving, Laus Deo, and Langdon suddenly understood. This is the true message of the base of the stone pyramid. The seven symbols are a transliteration, the simplest of ciphers. The symbols are letters. The stonemason's square, L. The element gold, AU. The Greek sigma, S. The Greek delta, D. Alchemical mercury, E. The Ouroboros, O. Laus Deo, Langdon whispered. The well-known Latin phrase meaning, praise God, was inscribed on the tip of the Washington Monument in script letters only 1 inch tall, on full display and yet invisible to all. Laus Deo. Praise God, Peter said behind him, flipping on the soft lighting in the chamber. The Masonic Pyramid's final code. Langdon turned. His friend was grinning broadly. And Langdon recalled that Peter had actually spoken the words, praise God, earlier inside the Masonic Library. And I still missed it. Langdon felt a chill to realize how apt it was that the legendary Masonic Pyramid had guided him here, to America's great obelisk, the symbol of ancient mystical wisdom, rising toward the heavens at the heart of a nation. In a state of wonder, Langdon began moving counterclockwise around the perimeter of the tiny square room, arriving now at another viewing window. North. Through this northward-facing window, Langdon gazed down at the familiar silhouette of the White House directly in front of him. He raised his eyes to the horizon, where the straight line of 16th Street ran due north toward the House of the Temple. I am due south of Herodom. He continued around the perimeter to the next window. Looking west, Langdon's eyes traced the long rectangle of the reflecting pool to the Lincoln Memorial, its classical Greek architecture, inspired by the Parthenon in Athens, temple to Athena, goddess of heroic undertakings. Anuit coeptis, Langdon thought. God favors our undertaking. Continuing to the final window, Langdon gazed southward across the dark waters of the tidal basin, where the Jefferson Memorial shone brightly in the night. The gently sloping cupola, Langdon knew, was modeled after the Pantheon, the original home to the great Roman gods of mythology. Having looked in all four directions, Langdon now thought about the aerial photos he had seen of the National Mall, her four arms outstretched from the Washington Monument toward the cardinal points of the compass. I am standing at the crossroads of America. Langdon continued back around to where Peter was standing. His mentor was beaming. Well, Robert, this is it. The lost word. This is where it's buried. The Masonic Pyramid led us here. Langdon did a double take. He had all but forgotten about the lost word.
Robert, I know of nobody more trustworthy than you.
And after a night like tonight, I believe you deserve to know what this is all about. As promised in legend, the lost word is indeed buried at the bottom of a winding staircase. He motioned to the mouth of the monument's long stairwell.
Langdon had finally started to get his feet back under him, but now he was puzzled. Peter quickly reached into his pocket and pulled out a small object.
"Do you remember this?"
Langdon took the cube-shaped box that Peter had entrusted to him long ago. "Yes, but I'm afraid I didn't do a very good job of protecting it." Solomon chuckled. "Perhaps the time had come for it to see the light of day." Langdon eyed the stone cube, wondering why Peter had just handed it to him.
"What does this look like to you?"
Peter asked.
Langdon eyed the number 1514 and the symbol of the D written inside the A, and recalled his first impression when Catherine unwrapped the package.
"A cornerstone."
"Exactly," Peter replied.
"Now, there are a few things you might not know about cornerstones. First, the concept of laying a cornerstone comes from the Old Testament."
Langdon nodded. "The Book of Psalms."
"Correct. And a true cornerstone is always buried beneath the ground, symbolizing the building's initial step upward out of the earth toward the heavenly light."
Langdon glanced out at the Capitol, recalling that its cornerstone was buried so deep in the foundation that, to this day, excavations had been unable to find it.
"And finally," Solomon said, "like the stone box in your hand, many cornerstones are little vaults and have hollow cavities so that they can hold buried treasures. Talismans, if you will. Symbols of hope for the future of the building about to be erected."
Langdon was well aware of this tradition, too.
Even today, masons lay cornerstones in which they sealed meaningful objects. Time capsules, photos, proclamations, even the ashes of important people.
"My purpose in telling you this," Solomon said, glancing over at the stairwell, "should be clear."
"You think the lost word is buried in the cornerstone of the Washington Monument?"
"I don't think, Robert. I know.
The lost word was buried in the cornerstone of this monument on July 4, 1848, in a full Masonic ritual."
Langdon stared at him.
"Our Masonic forefathers buried a word?"
Peter nodded.
"They did indeed. They understood the true power of what they were burying." All night, Langdon had been trying to wrap his mind around sprawling ethereal concepts. The ancient mysteries, the lost word, the secrets of the ages. He wanted something solid, and despite Peter's claims that the key to it all was buried in a cornerstone 555 feet beneath him, Langdon was having a hard time accepting it.
"People study the mysteries for entire lifetimes and are still unable to access the power allegedly hidden there." Langdon flashed on Dürer's Melancholia I,
the image of the dejected adept, surrounded by the tools of his failed efforts to unveil the mystical secrets of alchemy.
"If the secrets can actually be unlocked, they will not be found in one place."
Any answer, Langdon had always believed, was spread across the world in thousands of volumes,
encoded into writings of Pythagoras, Hermes, Heraclitus,
Paracelsus, and hundreds of others. The answer was found in dusty, forgotten tomes on alchemy, mysticism, magic, and philosophy. The answer was hidden in the ancient library of Alexandria, the clay tablets of Sumer, and the hieroglyphs of Egypt.
"Peter, I'm sorry," Langdon said quietly, shaking his head. "To understand the ancient mysteries is a lifelong process. I can't imagine how the key could possibly rest within a single word."
Peter placed a hand on Langdon's shoulder.
"Robert, the lost word is not a word."
He gave a sage smile.
"We only call it the word because that's what the ancients called it. In the beginning."
Chapter 130. In the beginning was the word. Dean Galloway knelt at the great crossing of the National Cathedral and prayed for America. He prayed that his beloved country would soon come to grasp the true power of the Word, the recorded collection of the written wisdom of all the ancient masters, the spiritual truths taught by the great sages. History had blessed mankind with the wisest of teachers, profoundly enlightened souls whose understanding of the spiritual and mental mysteries exceeded all understanding.
The precious words of these adepts, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad,
Zoroaster, and countless others,
had been transmitted through history in the oldest and most precious of vessels. Books. Every culture on earth had its own sacred book, its own word. Each one different, and yet each one the same. For Christians, the word was the Bible. For Muslims, the Quran. For Jews, the Torah. For Hindus, the Vedas. And on it went. The word shall light the way. For America's Masonic forefathers, the word had been the Bible. And yet few people in history have understood its true message. Tonight, as Galloway knelt alone within the great cathedral, he placed his hands upon the Word, a well-worn copy of his own Masonic Bible. This treasured book, like all Masonic Bibles, contained the Old Testament, the New Testament, and a treasure trove of Masonic philosophical writings. Although Galloway's eyes could no longer read the text, he knew the preface by heart. Its glorious message had been read by millions of his brethren in countless languages around the world. The text read, "Time is a river, and books are boats." Many volumes start down that stream, only to be wrecked and lost beyond recall in its sands. Only a few, a very few, endure the testings of time and live to bless the ages following. There is a reason these volumes survived while others vanished. As a scholar of faith, Dean Galloway had always found it astonishing that the ancient spiritual texts, the most studied books on earth, were, in fact, the least understood. Concealed within those pages, there hides a wondrous secret. One day soon the light would dawn, and mankind would finally begin to grasp the simple transformative truth of the ancient teachings, and take a quantum leap forward in understanding his own magnificent nature. Chapter 131. The winding staircase that descends the spine of the Washington Monument consists of 898 stone steps that spiral around an open elevator shaft. Langdon and Solomon were making their way down, Langdon still grappling with the startling fact that Peter had shared with him only moments ago. "Robert, buried within the hollow cornerstone of this monument, our forefathers placed a single copy of the Word, the Bible, which waits in darkness at the foot of this staircase." As they descended, Peter suddenly stopped on a landing and swung his flashlight beam to illuminate a large stone medallion embedded in the wall. "What in the world?" Langdon jumped when he saw the carving. The medallion depicted a frightening cloaked figure holding a scythe and kneeling beside an hourglass. The figure's arm was raised, and his index finger was extended, pointing directly at a large open Bible, as if to say, "The answer is in there." Langdon stared at the carving and then turned to Peter. His mentor's eyes shone with mystery. "I'd like you to consider something, Robert." His voice echoed down the empty stairwell. "Why do you think the Bible has survived thousands of years of tumultuous history? Why is it still here? Is it because its stories are such compelling reading? Of course not. But there is a reason. There is a reason Christian monks spend lifetimes attempting to decipher the Bible. There is a reason that Jewish mystics and Kabbalists pore over the Old Testament. And that reason, Robert, is that there exist powerful secrets hidden in the pages of this ancient book, a vast collection of untapped wisdom waiting to be unveiled." Langdon was no stranger to the theory that the scriptures contained a hidden layer of meaning, a concealed message that was veiled in allegory, symbolism, and parable. "The prophets warn us," Peter continued, "that the language used to share their secret mysteries is a cryptic one. The Gospel of Mark tells us, 'Unto you is given to know the mystery,' but it will be told in parable. Proverbs cautions that the sayings of the wise are riddles, while Corinthians talks of hidden wisdom. The Gospel of John forewarns, 'I will speak to you in parable, and use dark sayings.'" "Dark sayings," Langdon mused, knowing this strange phrase made numerous odd appearances in Proverbs as well as Psalm 78. "I will open my mouth in a parable, and utter dark sayings of old." The concept of a dark saying, Langdon had learned, did not mean evil, but rather that its true meaning was shadowed or obscured from the light. "And if you have any doubts," Peter added,
Corinthians overtly tells us that the parables have two layers of meaning. Milk for babes and meat for men. Where the milk is a watered-down reading for infantile minds, and the meat is the true message, accessible only to mature minds. Peter raised the flashlight, again illuminating the carving of the cloaked figure pointing intently at the Bible. I know you're a skeptic, Robert, but consider